Hey everyone, this is Jerry Papionik on KYGTLPFM 102.7 and 103.9 on the air in beautiful, gorgeous downtown Idaho Springs, Colorado, Clear Creek County, the center of the universe. And it's a lot of fun. Back on the air again, and a little bit of hiatus here and off and on. And we're going to do a little special show today, and which we'll get going here in a few minutes. And good stuff. And this is The Rabbit Hole. And I will be talking to you. I have a co-host on his way, and must have got a little delayed. So we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. But before we get into everything anyway, do want to thank our sponsors this hour here, Dex. And without Dex and all of other sponsors, this show and all the other shows here would not be possible on community radio, because this is how we make it, is with our volunteer efforts and so on there. So, we're going to be rocking and rolling here. So, and I want to give a shout out to also Tommyknockers, because Tommyknockers is one of our great community supporters. And if you want any great beers and so forth, you just got to head over there. And so I think it's on 14th and Minor Street. So we're ready to go. And I'm not going to be able to do the first part of the interview here, but I have someone who's going to be substituting with me. And of course, the show here is The Rabbit Hole. And one of the features that I'm going to institute is going to be called Writer's Talk. And so I'm not going to be able to interview the first writer, but I understand he's up and coming and will be one day a famous writer on the scene here. So I'm going to turn it over to Greg Markle, my good friend and founder of the radio station. So, Greg, welcome.
Thanks, co-founder Jerry. A lot of help along the way. Thanks. Thank you for the honor of coming in and interviewing you on your book.
Oh, is it my book we're talking about?
Why not start off with your book? The name of the book is Sisyphus Wins.
Yeah.
And I'm going to spell that S-I-S-Y. P-H-U-S, so you try to pronounce it.
Sisyphus.
Sisyphus.
Sisyphus Wins.
Okay.
Sisyphus is Greek.
And it was a great picture of the Mount Holy Cross that I'm sure you're going to explain in detail, but it's written by Jerry Fabianic, and it looks, I can't wait to talk about it.
All right, let's get right into it.
Okay, well, Jerry, why don't you give us an outline of the story?
Well, it's a story of a man reflecting back on his life, and he gets up. It's set in 2015. Gets up early in a summer morning, set in Colorado, and he decides he's going to be climbing a mountain that day. And it's a 14er. And for those that are not in Colorado, a 14er is any mountain that's over 14,000 feet. And in Colorado, we call bagging them. So if you get to the top of the 14ers, and officially we have 54, although there's some debate on it, but officially there's 54 14ers, so many tried to do it. At any rate, he wants to climb a 14er. He's really exhausted, tired, and, have to figure out why. And he's carrying a burden. He's actually going to carry a burden up the mountain, and he has a debate about which mountain he's going to do. And so the cover kind of gives it away, because you're right, it is the Mount of the Holy Cross that he is climbing. So as he starts his expedition that day, he has some struggles along the way, and one thing leads to another. I don't want to give too much on a spoiler alert, but at some point he begins to recollect, he starts to go back to a time in his life that the first one occurred back 20 years before in 1995, and he remembers back to that scene. and it's set in what is a Requiem Mass, a Requiem. And that's a traditional Latin Mass in the Roman Catholic Church. It's a funeral Mass. And so he goes to this funeral Mass, and during that funeral Mass is the time he begins to really recollect his life up to that point in time. So it was very interesting as a writer to work with the different tenses. You know, set in present tense, you go into past tense, and then you go with a really past tense. And also to organize it so that the reader is not confused and lost in the process of following the time frames, etc.
So there was this come to Jesus moment for the main character, right?
There is, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was this like a moment you had a certain aha moment to want to write the book, or was it from a series of creative sparks?
It's a combination. It's a great question. Some stuff had come down, and I'm really upfront about it. I don't go into detail about it, but I think it's important just to say that about 6 years ago, it was a really difficult time in life for me, really in a dark place. And I had to kind of figure out how to get through that time. And because we know there are people who deal with depression on a regular basis. I don't, but many of us do get into those times in our lives when it is a dark time. And how do we make our way through it? So I call it the three R's. And it was, for me, running, reading, and writing. And so for me, the running was just the energetic form of it. And I started running a whole lot more than I used to. Actually started running marathons and managed to knock six of them out along the way.
Would you think about writing or while you're running? Would you think about the book?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. And stuff started coming up, and I just wanted to start giving it creative expression. So while I was running, and then also reading, you know, my tracks, whatever it might be, more philosophical, my classic works. And I just started to sit, I sat down and just started writing with no intention of writing a novel. Things just started to flow out. And so then you talked about the creative sparks, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you started writing this book shortly after you had this time of your life that was in conflict or crisis and a big change in your life. And of course, the main character kind of goes through the same thing. So I guess It's fair to ask, is this book based on you?
In part, but it's a work of fiction. It's not my story, and I make that very clear. It's a story, and I like it for it to be a universal story. So regardless of the setting and the particulars of the characters, that hopefully it's well-written fiction. I believe it is. And when that's the case, no matter what the setting is, and people read, could then pick up on the theme and apply it to their own lives. So no, it's not a memoir. Of course, as a writer, we draw on what we know, especially first-time writers. And some of the, and large part of these stories, anecdotes within the stories, I drew on personal experience. But also, we're sitting here talking. I've known you for years and years, and you tell me your story. And here's the scary part. I remember people's stories, and as I'm writing, they come into mind. And they may not be exactly the form, but it gives me the kernel to work off of. And so it's a blend of mine and others, and then just simply creative element, to flesh it out.
But now, did you carve out a time of day to work on the book, or did you drive around like George Downing with a notebook on the seat of your truck in case you got an idea?
It was amazing because it came in fits and starts. At first, I was writing very intensively, and then it kind of went by the wayside. I'd come back to it again. Something kept drawing me back to that writing. And the one time I say I didn't write was on a bright, sunny day, because on bright, sunny days, I'm outside. I don't care what the temperature is. I'm just an outside type of guy. But nights, cold, dark, snowy days. I would wake up in the middle of the night and I couldn't sleep for whatever reason, go over and sit down and turn on the computer and just start writing. I'd kind of force myself into it, never thinking I was writing anything great. I'd come back to that a few weeks later, a month later, look at it and say, wow, you just don't know when it's going to happen. And so it just, variety of times.
So you would look This took you 5 years, so you would look back at something you wrote 5 years ago, go, wow, that's a great idea. Did you look back and say, what was I thinking?
yeah, because I, you know, it's funny on the various chapters, because as you follow the story through, once you start getting into it, you start following him from the time he's a little boy to a teenager, young adulthood, etc. But I didn't write it that way. You know, I might have written a chapter when he was like 7, then the next one was he was 25, and then he was 17. And then I mixed them up. I said, oh, this fits better over here, that sort of thing there too. So it just kind of, and then it started to take shape.
Uh-huh. The main character, what's his name?
Jonathan Slavenko.
So I don't know how much of a story you want to give away or anything, but mm-hmm. he has to decide which mountain to climb. And how does he settle on the Holy Cross?
Well, initially it's a fairly innocuous, you know, harmless. He's debating because Elbert in Colorado is the highest 14er. And Holy Cross, though, is barely a 14er, but it's one of the most arduous because of its length primarily. You start off at 10,000 feet, you hike up to Half Moon Pass at around 11, then you drop 900 feet into this valley. Then you start hiking up the actual mountain. So if you do it in one day, which I've done, it's a long day. And then when you get up above tree line, there's what we call bouldering. There's just massive boulders. And you're literally just hopping from boulder to boulder and stepping around them and everything too. So that took on, in the story, talks about how why he decides on Holy Cross for just that particular day. He has to deal with his old dog, and it was a 14er. He still needs to top off. But there's symbolism in it, too, because it is the mount of the Holy Cross, and he's carrying a burden. And, of course, we think of who carried a burden on his back with a cross, and then, of course, is the biblical allusion of Jesus in there, too. So it's
plus
a deeper...
Plus, you got Sisyphus.
Well,
was he the guy pushing the boulder?
He is.
Yeah.
So he's pushing the rock up the hill. That's from a Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, and so this is your first novel?
It is.
Yeah, and it's quite an undertaking, right? Writing a novel. Did you ever think there would ever get to the end of it?
No, I really, I never really thought, you know, earlier in my life that I wanted to write a book. But then again, when I was a young person, I never thought I wanted to be a teacher, and then I became that. I never thought about being a radio host, and here I am sitting with you 12 years later doing it, and so on. It just came together, and there was various individuals. They would read sections of it, and certainly were very encouraging. And about almost a year ago, with one of my friends, Jason Steinle, who is also my chiropractor, and he had published a book. And I would be talking to him about it, and he said, well, have you thought about really ultimately publishing it? And I said, well, I'm not sure if it's good enough, or all this other stuff, you know, all the doubts. And he encouraged me to join this group. It's called the Colorado Independent Publishers Association, CIPA for short. So I went to a meeting and joined up in last May, and I went in, and my first thought was, like, what are you doing here? You're not a writer. You don't belong with these people. You know, all the doubts and fears and all the stories. I like that concept of story, because a lot of us, we buy into stories that were written for us, and we accept them as personal truth, and they're not. And so I just said, okay, you're present. There's a reason I stayed there. Met the people get up on stage, and they just talk about, you know, the services they offer. And that includes anything from an editor to a publisher to whatever, all the aspects of publishing a book. And I was struck by this woman. Her name's Melanie Mulhall, and we actually ended up working together, and she edited the book. And when I sent her the manuscript, after she read it through, she said, wow, this is really good. She said, we have a lot of work to do, because I would write as an English teacher, because that's what I'm retired. She said, but a novel's a different... I had to pretty much there, but it needed some tightening up, you know, too many details, that sort of thing there. And I just, you know, let it go and let the universe decide. And one thing has led to another. And now I literally have a book. And a couple of weeks ago, I was at the CB meeting, and I stood up in front of them and held up the book. And so all the fears and doubts and everything else from 8-9 months ago, and here I was 8 months later standing up in front of these very successful people saying, I have a book. and how powerful that was for me to do that. It was amazing.
Did the book get easier to write as you kind of figured out things in your own life?
It did. You know, and I say that, and it's true, that it's not my story, but now that it's all done, I reflect on it, Greg, and I sort of have formed what I call like a symbiotic relationship with the work itself. So while it's not my story, it's just like I'm so connected to the story itself because it is a story. And I believe in the power of story. Joseph Campbell is one of my gurus. I mentioned him in the book, and he was the great mythologist, and you know, he's the one who, you know, studied religions, spiritual practices, whatever, all over the world. And he says, you know, we're all trying to figure out the same thing. Why are we here? How do we get here? And what's going to happen when we die? And that's what religion and mythology is all about. And it's the personal story that's there. And what was really, really powerful for me, after we went through the editing process and I was sitting with Melanie, we had agreed to meet for about maybe 2 hours. 3.5 hours later, we're still chatting. And all about the various aspects of the book. So she asked me about what the cover should look like. And when I had started writing the book, because it focused in large part on the Catholic Requiem Mass, that was a large part of the story. But as the story grew, as I wrote more and more, it became less and less a feature in it. And really, all it serves for in the story as a thread, it moves the reader through. And so what might have been 50 to 60% of the original work was down to like maybe 5%. I mean, it's very minimal. So nonetheless, the title of the story was Requiem for a Family. And so it started off when she said, well, what do you think what the cover should look like? And I said, well, I don't, you know, I'm thinking, you know, like it's a requiem and, you know, a casket with a black drape over it or something. And then it hit me and I thought, well, who wants to buy a book with a black drape casket on the front, right? And I said, so no, I don't think it's going to work. And she said, well, I was thinking of a mountain because he's on a mountain while he's telling his story. And as soon as she said that, I thought, Mount of the Holy Cross. That's important because that's where it takes place. He's on Mount of the Holy Cross. And I said, okay, it can't be just any mountain. It has to be Mount of the Holy Cross. So as we talked about it, and I said, well, then the title Requiem for Family, you know, A, it doesn't fit the story anymore, and B, that's kind of really, it doesn't match the picture of the mountain on there, you know, the same concept and everything. So we start kicking around different ideas, and after a few minutes, because I used a story as Sisyphus, the Greek, from Greek mythology, the one who was condemned by the gods to push a rock up a mountain. And when I thought of that, I just looked up at her and I said, Sisyphus wins. And that became the story. And then later that evening, as I was reflecting on our conversation and everything, that's when the power hit me that how much not only the story had changed from its roots, but how much I have changed along with it because I'm no longer in that place where I was when I started it. I'm in a very different place. And then it tells me the power of story, the power of writing, and when one believes in himself or herself and follows through. And that's one of the great lessons I would like to communicate, at least it worked for me, to others who go through their own trials and tribulations that you have it within. You can find that courage. You can move through it, but it takes work, lots of work to do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, can I ask how old you are, Jerry?
I just turned 66.
66. So given the benefit of being 66 years old, does that give you a comfortable distance from your years, like whenever Jonathan, how old he is? I mean, it does give you a way to reflect back and give you a new perspective on your formative years?
It does. You know, as an older, now senior citizen, and reflecting back over, I see, from my perspective, a trajectory in my life. I look at key events that happen and why I started off as a boy growing up outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to where we're sitting right now and having this conversation. There were key junctures in there. And hindsight, hindsight always proves that. You don't know when they're going to happen. And the change in me, not only from the beginning up till now, but it ties in with Joseph Campbell's, what he calls the monomyth, that, and you know, recently the episode 7 of Star Wars can help. But when you look at the original Star Wars series with Luke Skywalker all the way back 1977, so, and then Empire Strikes Back, and then Return of the Jedi, that is the story of the epic hero. And the way Campbell puts it in, you know, my words here, but I'm paraphrasing, is that in order to get to heaven, one must go through hell. And even in Christian belief, mythology, you know, Jesus dies, he descends into hell, and the third day he raises the dead, and off he goes into heaven. So in order to get to a higher level, if we don't go through the ordeal, whatever it might be, and for everybody it's different, you cannot achieve this greater place. And, you know, I'm no guru, I'm no goddess or god, I'm not the Buddha, anything like that. I'm just an old man who has a story to tell and loves to tell stories and encourages others to say, validate your life, look back over it, and, you know, and to move to this level that I think we all can achieve, and which is ultimately finding happiness in your life and you know, validation.
Well, from what you told us about the story, Jonathan decides to climb Mount Holy Cross. And is there anything else you want to tell us about the story to hook us in there? Without giving too much away?
Too much of it away. Let's just say it moves. In fact, if you would hand me, I got a copy of the book right here. If you would hand me that, please, thank you. Because on a couple of the reviews, and as soon as you open it up, you'll read Praise for Sisyphus Wins. And there's two in particular, a couple of them, but Joe Holub is an old friend of mine, but he's a retired pastor of a Lutheran church, and an honest and personal novel about what it was like to grow up in a staunch Catholic family in the 50s and beyond, and about how Jonathan navigates his way through treacherous course of self-discovery and eventual affirmation. Nancy Morris was a co-worker and someone I have a lot of respect for. She teaches at the Summit High School, right? She's a teacher, and an IB teacher. And she really gets into, at the end there, of her review about Fabianic's use of Christian imagery, a modern twist on Joseph Campbell's monomyth. And she calls it a journey worth taking. I'm just blown away by all of these. Jason Steinle, I mentioned him earlier.
The chiropractor.
And he has written his own book called Upload Experience. And it was interesting how he touched on it, too. He says, a sobering story of one man's struggle with himself, his family, and his church. Jerry Fabianic's Sisyphus Wins is a real page-turner, even when the reader is afraid of what the next page will reveal. Jerry masterfully dances back and forth between distressing life events, deep philosophical ponderings, and lighthearted experiences. The reader is ultimately left wondering where the line is between truth and fiction. And when I read that, I thought, now, even though I know my story and I read this and I go, okay, how much of this is true? How much is it fiction? It's so blurred to me. I'm not sure what is true and what is fiction.
Is there a part of that you want to read this or anything, a paragraph or... passage.
Wow. Yeah, there was a. Let me see if I could find it. So on my website, I have an excerpt, and let me see if I can find it. Here we go. Oh, I might have just gone to it. Here we go. This is a chapter here. Okay. This is from one of the later chapters in there, and he's now older, as an older man. Dressed in his standard casual attire of hiking shorts, runner's t-shirt, and running shoes, Jonathan sits on the ground with his knees pulled up in front of his chest, zips up his windbreaker, and wraps his arms around his legs to give him stability. Spring break could not have come at a more perfect time. He rolls more perfect over in his mind. The phrase irritates him, despite it being in the preamble to the Constitution. Precision in expression, written or spoken, has become an obsession with him. less than perfect is what we are. Yet, ironically, it is in our imperfection that we are perfect, he reasons. In an ongoing battle with the wind, he wraps his windbreaker tighter, pulls his baseball cap down, and pulls the hood of the windbreaker up over it. As a tern swoops overhead, he reflects on the last reading he did with his Honors American Lit class before spring break. British Lit is not his strength, but he enjoys reading The Rime of the Ancient Mariner after wrapping up Moby Dick. He tries to get his students to understand that the Ancient Mariner, along with Ahab and the rest of the sailors, serve as archetypes. He has found that it is easier to get a concept across when it is discussed in context. In one quarter, his students will be seniors in his friend Denise's class, and she appreciates the idea of his giving them a taste of her curriculum before they enter their last high school English class, which will be advanced placement level. Then they will stand a fighting chance of doing well with her demanding expectations. One of the challenges he enjoys most in the classroom is moving his students to a deeper appreciation of fiction. Well-written fiction, he explains, is truer than nonfiction because it deals with universal truths. Your truth and my truth always conflict because each person filters everything through their personal senses and the lens of their socialization. End of quote. Universal truth, personal truth. At what point will he own up to his? When will he act with courage and finally be true to himself? Coming out will be more likely, will more than likely cause the fabric of his family to be irrevocably torn. He thinks about the Islamic revolution in Iran and correlates the culture there to that of his own tribe. Both are led by an Ayatollah, different only in matters of faith. Dogma, the art of codifying the will and mind of God, knows no singular tradition. Across the globe, people live in worlds defined by such inanities, some on a grand scale and others in their tribes. The Greeks fought to the death at Salamis 2,500 years ago to defeat that notion, and here we are again progressing towards that same theocracy because we insist, as Camus, he's the French philosopher, on placing history on the throne of God. Fixing his gaze on the tumultuous waters of the Pacific and the windbreaker drawn tight in his knees to his chest, Jonathan noticed his mind darting from one story, one illusion to another. It is okay to him. It might be chaotic to others, but he finds an interconnectedness among all the stories that make sense to him. Unlike the Ancient Mariner, Jonathan has not committed some unforgivable act. He has shot no albatross, though he's fully aware that when Theodore learns his truth, God's wrath will descend. Jonathan's eye is caught by the sight of a gull landing on a rock formation to his right. Turning his attention to it, he says, "You try to fly faster than any gull, and for that you're condemned and ostracized. You ask the right question when you wonder why it is so hard to convince a bird that he is free and could prove it to himself. Well, Mr. Gull, I don't know myself. Is it because we're full of fear that we will be humiliated, demeaned, and degraded? Shame is the most powerful tool to get someone to submit to another's will. You tell your disciples that their bodies are nothing more than thought, and they can break the chains of their bodies by breaking the chains of their thoughts. But here's my contention, or my conundrum, Mr. Gall. If I live my life according to a lie and deny my truth, I am a coward. That's not honorable. But if I speak my truth, I am shamed."
Yeah, that's great, Jerry. Yeah, I'm watching you read that, and I can tell you're really engrossed in this in your own story there, or in that story, I mean. And
thank you. Yeah.
You really put a lot into it. Yeah. I'm married to a writing teacher, and one thing I noticed about her and her colleagues is that they always had the hardest time writing stuff because they knew, the rules associated with writing, and they were always so critical of stuff and their own writing that it was hard for them to actually produce something. Being an English teacher, did you have a hard time being too self-critical?
Yes. There is that because, and that's what Melanie taught me, my editor, and she said, okay, you need to step out of the English teacher mode and into a writer's mode. And I think what also helped me was, for years I've been the chief columnist here for the Clear Creek Current. And what I finally had discovered is that writing opinion articles is one style. Fiction is a whole other thing. And so I call it flipping a switch, literally. And what I would have to do is separate and do some meditative practice, go out and run, just shake the cobwebs or something, and literally just go into this other world. And then what the great beauty of this, because of my life experience of teaching and having an in-depth knowledge of American literature in particular, different works would come to mind. And here, when he's talking to a gull, he's talking to a seagull, and of course his name is Jonathan, so the quote, and literally it comes from Richard Bach's work, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He's talking to a gull, and so I'm drawing on that. So what I encourage the readers, as they're reading through the book, and you see Moby Dick, you see Rime of an Ancient Mariner, you see Jonathan Livingston Seagull, if you haven't read them, or if you haven't read them a long time, pull them back up and read them, get some background, because the allusions just flow in. But yeah, what Amber is saying, I mean, it's difficult to step from that teaching mode, that critical mode, into let it go. And that's what you have to do, is simply let go. Trust the universe. Trust your fingers to fly across. And don't force stuff. And when you start working on that, it just, I don't know, magically starts coming forth.
Well, how can someone get a copy of your book?
There's a couple of ways. You can go to my website, jerryfabianic.com, and there's a link. You can order right off of Amazon. But if you would like a personally endorsed copy, you can still go there and contact me, and you could just email me at jerry@jerryfabianic.com. And I'll be more than delighted to send you a personal copy.
You better spell Jerry Fabianic.
Okay, Jerry with a J, so it's J-E-R-R-Y. And Fabianic is F as in Frank, A, B as in boy, Y, A, N, Nancy, I, C, .com. And just get in touch. I love it. And I'm creating a blog on my website, so I would love to get feedback from people, and so people could tell their stories too, and, you know, to help them. That's really, I want a conversational piece going here.
Oh, well, thanks for having me in to interview you, Jerry, on your book, and congratulations.
Thank you.
It's no small feat writing a novel. How many pages is it?
272.
Yeah.
272. And the original work, when I finished, even after I edited out a lot, was up to like 325. And I started to excise a lot, particularly the elements of the mask. Because what I understood, I said earlier, that my use of the ritual of the Catholic Mass, Requiem Mass, it just became like a thread. So there wasn't a need to go into depth. The fact he's there and there's some rituals going on is good enough, because it's really about his story. So literally, I just went in there and just started taking out chunks and paragraphs and everything, because it was just too much. And I was able to pare it down, and then Melanie, my editor, pared it down even more. And she said, okay, we get the picture, okay? Mm-hmm. He's in a bar, you know? You don't have to describe the fixture on the wall to say he's in a bar, you know? So
So a soft copy costs how much?
$19.95 and sales tax. So generally, if I sell it, because I'm in Georgetown, so it's 7%, so $21.35. And then the hardcover is $29.95, so it's $210 on that. And then, you know, shipping a little bit, so $3-4 on the shipping charge, you know. But I'm more than happy, more than delighted to mail them out to people. And I'm just excited that people would read it. And I want to hear back from them. I'm not one who just say, oh, read my book and thank you for buying it. I need to hear back, because this is about conversation, dialogues about people's stories. So
all right.
I'm excited.
JerryFabianic.com.
Right on, Greg.
Okay.
Thank you. And before we go, this one is for you, Mr. Markle.
Oh, come on. Really? You going to sign it for me?
I already did.
All right.
All the way to the back.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you. And not only for this, but because if it weren't for you and your co-founders, Bob Bacon among them and others, we wouldn't have this incredible media outlet here called KYGT.org. You know, we're on the air. We only have, 2,000 watts signal here in the valley, the Clear Creek Valley?
Yeah.
But we're on the internet. And I got people listening all over the United States listening to us right now because we're on the internet and we're just as powerful as any radio station.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I think, I mean, we're heard in 42 countries, and it's hard to believe that some guy in the Canary Islands is listening to us right now. And hello, whoever you are, because we see that you pop up once in a while. So that's without even, really pursuing this. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we're getting out there. So it's really fascinating, the internet and the people you can reach.
Oh, absolutely. And as I said earlier, because a feature of my show now, I'm on biweekly from 2 to 4 o'clock Mountain Time, is that I hope every week I will have at least one author come in and talk about his or her work, just like I have too, and, to open up our minds and what got him or her into and what's that story about. And a whole panoply of genres, whatever, it doesn't matter there. But again, storytelling, power of information, communication, and we wouldn't be sitting here talking if you didn't have that kernel inside of you. What, 20 years, 25 years? How long have we been doing
Yeah, that? I don't know. Yeah, I believe me. I think we got a long way to go, but it's been 22 years. Yeah.
An amazing thing here. So,
well, thanks,
all right.
Jerry.
All right. Thanks, Greg. And what I'm going to do, folks, I got to check and make sure what I got here in the hopper is, as you might have picked up in the novel, I actually reference a lot of a variety of songs and works of literature and so forth. And one of the songs that you get, and many, I mean, if you go back, classic rock, rock and roll and everything, I do quite a bit of them in there. And one in particular, he's sitting in a bar, he's 20-something, and it's back in the 70s. And one of the great hits of the 70s was Billy Joel's Piano Man, and I mention it in there. So what we're going to do is a little bit of music here, and let's listen to a little bit of Piano Man, and we'll continue a little bit later. All right, thank you.